This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 4th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Egypt, protesters mourn the death of an activist allegedly tortured by security forces. It's the latest in several allegations of abuse under President Morsi.
We saw horrific torture and still see horrific torture by the army in cases where they are detaining civilians.
A human rights report criticizes U.S. incarceration and the effects on people of color and immigrants. And we'll go to Washington State, where regulators and the public are discussing how to implement the state's new market for recreational marijuana. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Civil rights attorneys in New York filed a federal motion today to stop the New York Police Department from spying on Muslims solely on the basis of their religion. Further, they asked for an independent auditor to oversee the NYPD to ensure that the department complies with the law. According to the New York Civil Liberties Union, officers have continued to watch restaurants, bookstores, and mosques and eavesdropped on conversations without any evidence of wrongdoing. The motion specifically asks the court to ban the police from joining, visiting, and infiltrating Muslim institutions without a reasonable indication of unlawful activity. India's president signed off on a new law imposing stricter sentences for sexual assaults. The bill was hastily crafted amid public outcry after the December murder and gang rape of a student in New Delhi. But women's rights groups say the new measures don't go far enough. Sharia Niazi reports.
President Pranab Mukherjee signed a quickly passed sexual violence law that increases penalties for rape and allows capital punishment if the victim dies or is left in a persistent vegetative state. The ordinance followed a detailed report on the issue by the Justice Verma Committee and was passed by the Union Cabinet last Friday. But the Verma Committee put forward thousands of recommendations that went beyond sentencing guidelines and sought to address cultural issues as well. Several women's rights groups and a number of political parties opposed the measure. They said that the government should have discussed and debated the bill. They're calling for any number of amendments, including increased penalties for acid attacks and the inclusion of marital rape and rapes committed by the police or military. They also want an end to the two-finger test in which rape victims are internally examined to determine prior sexual activity. The ordinance takes effect immediately but must be formally approved by Parliament within 6 months. Shura Niazi, FSRN, India.
Somalia's new president says he will not intervene in the case of a rape victim on trial for insulting a government body.
My interference to the judicial system does not help solve the problem. The problem is setting up the institutions, reviewing. If there are mistakes, we rectify. But me to interfere the justice system will never help the rule of law in Somalia.
But President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed adds that his government will do more to protect victims of sexual assault.
We have established a task force, special security forces that are specifically there to investigate, to go after the rape cases.
A 27-year-old Somali woman was reportedly raped by government soldiers while living in a displaced persons camp near Mogadishu. She, her husband, and a journalist who interviewed her have all been charged with fabricating the story and face jail terms if convicted. Both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say the manner in which the case has been handled discourages women from reporting sexual assaults. UNICEF announced today that a large-scale operation is underway in Syria to provide safe water supplies for more than 10 million people. That's close to half the country's population. Don Bob reports from the UN.
The first four trucks carrying 80 tons of sodium hypochlorite to water chlorination supplies crossed the Jordanian border into Syria on Sunday, heading for Homs, Aleppo, Hama, and Idlib. Over the coming weeks, UNICEF will deliver 1,000 tons of chlorine to cities and communities across all 14 governorates in Syria. UNICEF's representative in Syria, Yusuf Abdel Jalil, says this shipment is very timely as supplies of chlorine in Syria have fallen dangerously low, making access to safe water challenging for many families, adding that this puts the population and children, especially, at high risk of contracting diarrhea and other waterborne diseases. The operation comes amid rising concern over the impact of the 23-month conflict on water pumping stations and other vital infrastructure, and the implications for children's health in particular. Reports say that the quality and quantity of water supplies continues to deteriorate in different parts of the country and in some areas very severely. Don Bob, United Nations.
And today marks the 100th birthday of civil rights activist and icon Rosa Parks. In 1955, Parks refused to cede her seat on an Alabama bus to a white passenger, sparking the 381-day Montgomery bus boycott. Parks died in 2005. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Egypt, a young activist was pronounced dead after being taken into police custody at a protest last week. Thousands filled the streets of Cairo for his funeral today, many outraged at the news that his body showed signs of torture and abuse. The death of Mohamed El-Gindi, an activist with the popular Current Party, is one of several incidents of apparent torture at the hands of police or security forces under President Mohamed Morsi. A report from the El Nadim Center for Victims of Torture in October 2012 called torture systematic and documented numerous abuses during Morsi's first 100 days in office. For more, we're joined by Sharif Kabir with the Mosserin Independent Media Collective. He joins us from Cairo. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you.
Now, according to the popular Current Party, Mohamed El-Gindi went missing after participating in the protest in January 27th in Tahrir Square. What else is known about how Mohamed El-Gindi died?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit known. The medical examiner's report on El-Gindi showed that he had electric shocks on his tongue. He was strangled with wires around his neck. He was beaten mercilessly and had burns on the rest of his body. I mean, his body is complete testament to what could only be torture. Like you said, he was disappeared effectively from a protest several days ago. No one knew anything about his whereabouts when suddenly, you know, after lawyers looking for him, after going to every prison, to every hospital, even to the morgue, he was found out in the desert, effectively near Jabal Ahmar, which is Central Security Forces, which is the riot police. It's one of their barracks, effectively, and he was found there and taken to hospital. And today he succumbed to just really, really horrific torture and abuse.
Originally, according to The Guardian, at least, the government was saying that hospital records show El-Gindi died of a car crash. Do you know if the government has revised that in the light of this evidence, or are they still maintaining that account?
You know, I don't know. It's difficult to tell. These stories change almost daily now with the government moving between trying to kind of blankly deny things to coming around and, you know, well, denying them by other means. I think the issue is not whether they, you know, lie and try and cover it up, but who will pay for it? Who will be culpable? You know, who will be held accountable for what's happened here? And, you know, there's a lot of anger in the streets now. There's a lot of anger amongst people at seeing a new torture case just a day after a video was broadcast around the entire country of the same Central Security Forces beating, dragging, and stripping naked an elderly demonstrator in the streets outside of the presidential palace.
Well, there are these other accounts, and before we go there, tell us more about Mohamed El-Gindi. What was he known for? Had he been involved in protests in the past?
Well, yeah, that's the thing about him. He wasn't necessarily a well-known figure. He went out to the protest. He was a member of the Popular Current Party. He participated in demonstrations. But he wasn't a celebrity, and I think this is what we've been seeing. We see disappearances like this coming from middle-class, lower-middle-class youth suddenly not being found and not being being registered at police stations, as we've seen before, and turning up either at courthouses with signs of torture and being badly beaten, or at Central Security Forces barracks. You know, the strategy, I think, is made to target people like Gindi, who are anybody and everybody, you know, who are the rank and file, not the celebrities, to just terrorize and scare and say that we're not just going after famous personalities. You know, the Ministry of Interior, the police, the government have a vendetta against anyone who would go and attempt to demonstrate against their authoritarian behaviors.
There are also these other cases. There's the report of Mohammed Said, a 20-year-old protester who died in clashes last Friday. Some of the incidents that you refer to are reminiscent of the well-known case of Khalid Said, an opposition activist tortured and killed under Hosni Mubarak. How widespread is torture by police or security forces under President Morsi?
I think that what we're seeing now is that torture by police and security forces, whether it's that includes the army. We saw horrific torture and still see horrific torture by the army in cases where they are detaining civilians. So what we're seeing is a kind of, you know, the attempts to kind of negotiate power at the top levels are resulting in just horrific, horrific conditions for, you know, ordinary citizens. But there are a lot of other cases, and a lot of these are minors, even held with adults, beaten, tortured. There's a minor under 18 years old in a jail in Alexandria who has cancer and is not receiving treatment out of spite from the judge and the police on that particular case. There are over 250 detainees from this last round of clashes alone, a lot of them minors, all of them tortured, all of them beaten. And this is something that, you know, has to be emphasized and explains, I think, and justifies really whatever actions people in the street are taking right now.
Sharif Gaber joined us from Cairo. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find links to videos from the Mosserine Independent Media Collective on our website, fsrn.org. Over the weekend, Israeli settlers and soldiers attacked a protest camp set up by Palestinian activists on lands owned by farmers from Burin Village, northern West Bank. The Israeli military said that activists threw stones at troops and were met by tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. But Palestinian activists said they were first attacked with stones themselves by settlers. An AFP reporter was among the injured and reported that soldiers threatened to come to his house and arrest him as well. This violence comes as Israeli troops conducted multiple pre-dawn raids, arresting three Hamas lawmakers and more than a dozen Palestinian men. FSRN's Ghassan Bonora has more on the story.
Israeli army raids were reported in four cities, including Qalqilia, Nablus, Ramallah, and Hebron. Among those arrested were Ahmed Attoun, a Jerusalem legislator who was forcibly exiled to Ramallah by Israel 2 years ago, as well as MPs Hatem Kafisha and Muhammad Attal from Hebron. Members of the Palestinian parliament voiced concerns and asked the international community to intervene to stop Israeli violations against elected officials. Fouad Koukale is a Palestinian lawmaker.
The detention of lawmakers is illegal, but the Israelis do not care about international laws and norms. That's why Israel targets the MPs who only provide services to the people. Israel punishes by targeting our representatives and our people in general.
The three legislators are representatives of the Islamic Hamas party. Hamas sources said that Israel targeted the MPs to hamper Palestinian efforts seeking national unity between Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza. Sundus Kafisha's father, Hatem, is one of the MPs who was arrested. She described the raid on her home and the arrest of her father.
My dad is 52 years old and suffers from diabetes and high blood pressure. Soldiers stormed our home around 12:30 a.m., then told my father that they want to arrest him. They searched the house and took his mobile phone and computer, then searched the entire house and ransacked it, even our wardrobes. They searched them and removed all our clothes and left them on the ground. The closets of my youngest brothers were searched as well.
يعني أولي أولاد الصغار يعني إلي إخوتي الصغار برضو فتشوهم نفلوا.
Kafisha is concerned for her father. The Israeli army arrested him twice before and he spent 2 years each time in administrative detention with no charges against him filed. According to the Palestinian parliament, Israel now detains 15 Palestinian MPs after Monday's arrests. The raids are part of a pattern targeting West Bank communities. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, last week alone, the Israeli army conducted at least 75 raids, arresting 33 Palestinian civilians, including 5 teens. In addition to raids, lethal use of force has killed at least 5 Palestinians in the West Bank since the beginning of the year, including a 21-year-old woman who was shot in the face last month while walking to a college near Hebron. Ghassan Badnoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
Palestinian human rights advocates are welcoming a recent report on the impact of Israeli settlements. The UN Human Rights Council appointed a fact-finding mission last year. Their findings, released last week, say that the Israeli government continues to pursue illegal settlement expansion that violates international human rights law. UN Radio's Diane Penn reports.
The members of the International Fact-Finding Mission say the settlements are established and developed for the exclusive benefit of Israelis and maintained and advanced through a system of total segregation. French judge Christine Chanet, chairperson of the three-person mission, describes them as a kind of creeping annexation of Palestinian land. She says transferring civilians in an occupied territory is prohibited under the Geneva Convention.
To maintain such a system of segregation, you need strict police and army control. It means a lot of checkpoints. It means a violation of the freedom of movement, no access to natural resources, demolition of houses, and sometimes destroying even the trees.
The International Fact-Finding Mission was appointed last June by the UN Human Rights Council. It heard from academics, lawyers, diplomats, officials, victims, and NGOs, including from Israeli civil society. Judge Chanet, the chairperson, says they carefully analyzed and cross-checked the information received. Because the Israeli authorities did not respond to its letters, the mission could not enter the country and thus worked from Jordan. Asma Jahangir is a leading human rights lawyer from Pakistan.
And looking at the facts, we have given the finding and the conclusions, which say, number one, that the violations that have been carried out seriously impinge upon the self-determination of the Palestinian people. Number two, we are very concerned about the fact that the rights of the child in the Palestinian territory have been violated time and again. Number three, what is that it is an offense under international law. How that is going to play out, its implementation, is something for the international institutions to take up and decide in the parameter of their jurisdiction and their procedures and legislation.
The three lawyers call on Israel to cease activities related to the settlements and to ensure justice for all victims. Their report will be formally presented to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva in March. Diane Penn, United Nations.
The recently released World Report from Human Rights Watch outlines which countries have made progress toward equality and justice and which have allowed or supported violations of international law in the past year. The study cites extrajudicial killings in Syria, a controversial new constitution in Egypt, discrimination against women in Saudi Arabia, and legal impunity in Indonesia as particular concerns. But researchers also looked at the state of human rights in the U.S., faulting government policies that lead to the mass incarceration of immigrants and people of color, many of whom have never committed a violent crime. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Antonio Giannato with Human Rights Watch says his team of researchers looked at several types of U.S. human rights violations for this year's report, including unregulated child farm labor, the expiration of the Violence Against Women Act, and the CIA's Targeted Killing Drone Program. But their 2013 analysis especially focuses on U.S. policies that support mass incarceration.
The U.S. has the largest incarcerated population in the world at 2.1 million. the highest per capita incarceration rate, and it's driven by excessive, unfair, mandatory, and arbitrary sentences. You also see that the U.S. punishes children in ways that no other country does. Even with the Supreme Court passing cases that address the issue of life without parole for people who are sentenced before the age of 18, there are still people who were sentenced when they were young who have had no chance to benefit from the Supreme Court cases. They haven't been applied retroactively.
While California, Louisiana, and some other states have chosen to re-examine the cases of prisoners sentenced as minors, many others will leave those life sentences in place. The report also highlights the widespread use of solitary confinement for both children and adults in U.S. prisons. Human Rights Watch found that many of the nearly 100,000 people under 18 held in adult prisons are held in solitary. Janata says this has a severe impact on mental health and can make rehabilitation more difficult, especially when the isolation lasts a long time.
When the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture declared last year that excessive solitary confinement is confinement beyond 15 days, it's an amazing disconnect with what really happens in U.S. prisons, where people are held in solitary confinement sometimes for decades.
The report also cites a dramatic increase in the incarceration of immigrants, fueled by state laws and federal programs like secure communities that boost arrests of undocumented people. Human Rights Watch says tens of thousands of non-citizens are being held at about 250 facilities around the country. And immigrants' rights advocates, including Silky Shaw with the Detention Watch Network, says the conditions at those facilities don't meet international human rights standards, especially prisons run by private companies with little government oversight.
What we found was that there was a lot of arbitrary use of solitary confinement, abuse by guards. Access to lawyers is also a huge issue. And also the food is terrible. Sometimes people would find, you know, bugs and other things in their food. Things aren't heated. I mean, they're just in this situation where they're not being taken care of at all.
The Detention Watch Network is calling on the Obama administration to close the 10 immigrant detention jails with the worst conditions, including Georgia's Stewart Detention Center and Arizona's Pinal County Jail. And both that organization and Human Rights Watch are urging the government to consider alternatives to detention for nonviolent offenders who don't present a flight risk. The U.S. government has also come under fire for legislating indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens and non-citizens. The Human Rights Watch report cites provisions in the 2011 and 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, that could take away people's right to a trial and turn their right to free association into the crime of material support for terrorism. A federal judge blocked this section of the law in September.
Unfortunately, as soon as the judge issued the order, the Obama Justice Department put in an appeal.
That's attorney Carl Mayer, who represents the coalition of journalists and activists who are challenging the law. He'll be arguing this week against lawyers from the U.S. Justice Department and Senate, who have said the indefinite detention powers are necessary to keep the nation safe.
This is unconstitutional because it violates the Fifth Amendment, Equal Protection Clause. Our other argument is it violates the First Amendment because it chills free speech of these activists and journalists.
The Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan will consider whether or not to uphold the injunction against the NDAA's indefinite detention provisions on Wednesday. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Washington state, hundreds of people are attending public hearings on the implementation of recreational marijuana. Initiative 502, passed by voters last November, legalized the possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use. The measure also directed the Washington State Liquor Control Board to develop a state-regulated marketplace for the cultivation, processing, distribution, and sale of marijuana for recreational use. But as the state gathers public input on how to implement the law, it may also soon find itself in the middle of a fight with the federal government. FSRN's Devin Terriot-Orr and Joshua C. Robinson report from Seattle.
Since the passage of Initiative 502, state leaders have been focusing on two questions: how to implement the newly legal recreational marijuana market, and how the federal government will respond. At a recent public forum in Seattle, hundreds packed a meeting room and overflowed into the city council chambers above to share their thoughts on issues like quality control and ensuring a fair marketplace for small businesses. Some are also raising concerns about areas not specifically covered by the new law. Dave Baxter is a local hemp advocate who would like to legally produce cannabis and its non-psychoactive cousin, hemp, which I-502 does not require the board to address.
I'm hoping that we're not going to be strictly limited to marijuana. I think the plant has many uses and should be able to be used for, you know, the hemp seed is a complete food. It's also great for oil. It's the same viscosity and burning characteristics as number two diesel fuel. Our state has the chance to set a precedent in, you know, domestic hemp production.
Other attendees had no personal stake in the outcome, but merely wanted to be part of an unprecedented event. Merritt Long served the state of Washington for more than three decades, including stints as the director of the Human Rights Commission, and even from 2001 until 2006, as the chair of the Liquor Control Board. He termed the forum historic.
When I was chair of the board, I had a call over a decade ago from several attorneys in Seattle, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, professors at the University of Washington, others who were interested in how could the state stores be used if and when marijuana would be legalized. And so to have that history in terms of that idea and then to be here tonight with that has happened, I just felt I had to come.
The largest hurdle standing before those trying to implement the new law will likely not be the result of local issues, however. It is the fact that cannabis remains a Schedule I narcotic according to the federal government, a classification reserved for dangerous drugs with no medicinal benefit and a high potential for abuse. And that does not seem likely to change anytime soon. Attorney Anthony Gibbs advises clients in the medical marijuana industry.
I mean, Obama has shown that he has no spine in this matter whatsoever. The infamous Holder memorandum, right, that said, you know, they will not prosecute people who are in unambiguous compliance with state law. No one in the nation is in unambiguous compliance with state law because there's no such thing.
The judicial branch does not seem any more likely to shed light on this discrepancy between state and federal law. Last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit rejected a petition to require the Drug Enforcement Administration to reschedule cannabis to place it in the same category as prescription medicines. Many state officials drawing up regulations for over-the-counter marijuana sales are nonetheless optimistic. Sharon Foster is the chair of the Washington State Liquor Control Board.
I think at this point we have assurances from our governor that we should move forward on implementing rules, and that comes from a conversation that our Attorney General Ferguson and Governor Inslee have had back east with the U.S. Attorney Holder. I don't know. I think if we regulate well enough, if we control enough, and that hopefully they will let us implement 502 as the voters wanted us to.
It's not just the federal government and citizenry of Washington that have their eye on the state's actions. Kevin Oliver is the executive director of the state affiliate for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He says Washington State's decisions on cannabis regulation could have a much wider impact.
As someone who has been fielding media for several months, including local, state, national, and international media, interviews from Seattle to Paris, Spokane to Norway, including a television interview this morning with France's largest national media, TV1, with over 8 million viewers, I can tell you with some observational authority that the whole world is watching you guys.
Washington is holding four more forums over the next month and accepting public input on licensing requirements. After that, the Liquor Control Board will start accepting applications for the permits themselves. If all goes to plan and the federal government does not intervene, the likely-to-be-renamed Washington Liquor Cannabis Control Board will be issuing licenses to produce, process, and sell recreational marijuana by the end of the year. Reporting with Joshua C. Robinson, this is Devin Terrio Orr, FSRN, Seattle.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.